Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dervagh MacDonald with you this morning. Our panel have been busy, in conclave as it were, selecting the best and the rest from this morning's newspapers. But before I introduce them to you, let's have a look at what is making the headlines this morning. And it's no surprise that there is wall-to-wall coverage of the funeral of Pope Francis in Rome yesterday, with galleries of images, including that potentially historic image of US and Ukrainian Presidents Donald Trump and Vladimir Zelensky seated opposite each other in a 15-minute bilateral meeting held in St. Peter's Basilica before the Requiem Mass of the late Pontiff. The Sunday Times has a four-page picture spread wrapping the main paper with striking images of the funeral, but it is that one-to-one meeting between Mr. Trump and Mr. Zelensky that forms its main story. Hopes for peace after Vatican summit is the main lead, with reports that a Ukraine-Russia peace deal appeared to be inching closer after the intense exchanges in St. Peter's Basilica. The Sunday Times also carries a front page interview with former Irish President Dr. Mary McAleese, who joined us yesterday for the funeral coverage, who has criticised what she has described as the fake theology that bans women from becoming priests. The Irish Mail on Sunday, which is reissuing its commemorative Pope Francis coin, first launched during the Pope's visit to Ireland in 2018, carries a front page picture of the funeral cortege as it is driven through the streets of Rome and past the Colosseum. For two unforgettable hours, as sun poured down on the Vatican, a bitterly divided world came together, writes David Jones, who is leading out on 10 pages of in-depth coverage in the Mail on Sunday. The Sunday Independent carries an image of Pope Francis's simple wooden and zinc coffin filing past a line of world leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron and Mr. Trump, whose blue suit and blue tie stands out in an otherwise sea of black mourning attire. Opting for a colour piece for its lead, the paper's off-lead reports that Ireland's new housing czar, former NAMA chief executive Brendan McDonagh, will retain his NAMA salary as he takes up his role next month, leading the new housing activation office. And in what is labelled as an exclusive, the Business Post leads with a report that businesses are to get more time to prepare for the introduction of auto enrolment pensions for more than 800,000 workers. The auto enrolment, which had been due to go live this September, will be pushed back to next year under a proposal by Social Protection Minister Dara Cleary, who will seek Cabinet approval for the delay on Tuesday. The funeral of Pope Francis and the joint meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Zelensky also provides front-page images for many of the tabloids. Hope amid the tears is the lead for the Irish Sunday Mirror, and it is rest in peace for the Irish Sun and Sunday. Meanwhile, the Sunday World leads with a report on the release of convicted child killer Jerome Kavanagh, who was released from Shelton Abbey prison last week after serving 3 decades in jail. Across the Irish Sea, the final journey of Pope Francis is relegated somewhat in the Sunday Telegraph, which carries that image of Presidents Trump and Zelensky in St. Peter's Basilica. Trump turns against Putin is the headline, with columnist Tim Stanley saying, "It's almost as if from beyond the grave, the wily Argentine conspired to bring peace a little closer to Ukraine, and for a Pope who railed against war and urged the world to build bridges, not walls," something that was echoed in the homily by Cardinal Ray yesterday, "that would indeed be a fitting legacy." Well, joining me to go through all the papers are Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Sunday Times, Dr. Graeme Finlay, Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations in UCD, Aideen Hayden, housing policy expert and author and former chairperson of Threshold, and David Quinn, columnist with the Sunday Independent and the Irish Catholic. You're all very, very welcome. David, incredible efficiency, as we heard in the news there. Not only has Pope Francis been buried, but he's already been open to pilgrims to go and pay tribute to him this morning. What were you thinking when you were reading the coverage of the funeral? How do you think his funeral was received, broadly?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, it was, as you'd expect, a very beautiful occasion yesterday, a very beautiful ceremony. Rome providing its usual magnificent backdrop to everything. St. Peter's looking amazing. I mean, in a way, St. Peter's is an expression of the ability of the Italians to make everything look beautiful. It's the most remarkable country. You know, we saw all the world leaders there. We saw several hundred thousand people gathered in St. Peter's Square and down the streets around it. Interestingly, and probably not surprisingly, one of the most arresting images, which you alluded to come from the day, was Donald Trump. and of course Vladimir Zelensky sitting in all places,
St. Peter's Basilica.
Having some kind of an impromptu summit, the content of which we don't necessarily know yet. But anyway, I presume we'll get around to Ukraine and what's going on there soon. But yesterday was an occasion to say a proper and fitting farewell to the man, Pope Francis. 12 years Pope. He was a very impactful Pope, you'd have to say. From the moment he appeared out in the balcony of St. Peter's 12 years ago, he was dressed in simple white. He takes the name Pope Francis. He moves across in the papal apartments into what is a hotel on the other side of St. Peter's Square. He gets driven around in a small car, not a big one. He very much reaches out to the poor. And you see, because he was a pope from the global south, that's kind of what you'd expect. He was the first pope from outside Europe in many centuries and the first ever from South America. And so he very much had that kind of thing in mind. It was a Brazilian cardinal when he was elected turned to him and said, don't forget the poor. And he didn't. And that was probably one of the main themes of his pontificate, not to do that. And I'm saying in my piece today, actually, the aspect of his pontificate that would have struck me the most was, while he didn't change any of the fundamental teachings of the church, he did try to soften their application. So if we take
did succeed in softening the church's image, didn't he?
Yes, he did. But there was one particular thing, and this is quite early in his pontificate. I mean, the church is very strict about things like divorce and remarriage. And that means actually a divorced and remarried Catholic, strictly speaking, can't receive communion. So he puts out a document in which he says there are actually circumstances under which a divorced and remarried Catholic ought to be able to receive communion and not feel so estranged from the church. And this is what he was trying to do all the time, not change the teachings but soften the application, which is why he spoke so often about mercy. I remember somebody said to me, and this struck me a couple of years ago, he said, when there are very strict standards, very high standards, you need lots of mercy. And in this country, of course, we had the very high standards without much mercy. And I think Pope Francis would have been horrified by the kind of authoritarian church we had here in the past, and probably which he saw in Argentina growing up. And that is why he wanted a softer application and more merciful application of those very high teachings.
Alison O'Connor, he wanted a much simpler funeral, but he could not escape the pageantry and the tradition and the ceremony that ultimately attended his funeral yesterday.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a visual feast, there's no doubt. And
the Sunday Times has an amazing...
Yeah, it is. It captures the whole thing. And as David said, the stunning beauty of Rome. And I mean, I suppose being able to carry that off and so seamlessly is quite a feat. For me, it was also just the kind of normality of it. Everything in the world has been so sort of crazy and so much turmoil. To see that happening as it's supposed to see world leaders sitting together, even earlier in the week when they were paying tribute to the Pope, there was some comfort in that we still have that sort of decency there. And I suppose I'm writing about this myself today in the Sunday Times about how he was a pope that certainly changed the conversation, but there were no changes to the catechism. And for me, and that Sunday Times wraparound shows it, really does show it. You look at the photographs. I mean, it was basically a bloke fest yesterday. The odd woman.
Sister Anne Codd, who was on this yesterday, reminded us there weren't too many female political leaders there either.
Yeah, no, that this is true. And I mean, it's odd for me. And I mean, there was that sense that the women were in behind making the sandwiches. Do you know what I mean? That all the important jobs were done by the men. And she's quite right. It comes down to ceding power. And that's why you don't have, you look at the state of female political representation in this country. But I mean, I agree completely with Mary Mac. And she knows a lot more about this than I do in terms of her.
She has a doctorate.
Her theological expertise, where she's talking about this fake theology and false barriers as to why women can't become priests. Now, I do think she lets herself down a little bit when she starts talking about Cardinal Kevin Farrells, who's the Camerlengo. Who is now in charge of the Vatican, and she and he have beef, you know. I mean,
Vatican.
I understand why she feels that way. You know, he banned her from taking part in a conference on women priests in the Vatican, but she does veer into mean girls territory when she talks about that he didn't get the memo when he turned up to escort the Pope's coffin in wearing, she said, that ridiculous cope from I don't know what century. You know, I think she, you know, we could have done without that, maybe.
Well, it was certainly Graham, ceremony and tradition there. In terms of a lot of the coverage, particularly, I'm sure actually Mary McAleese would probably maybe just dispute that characterisation, Alison. But Graham, I wanted to just talk about the tone and the eulogy, because a lot of particularly the international writers are saying, look, I'm not a Catholic, but I was really, really moved by this. Or anybody who was covering it or otherwise took part in it, kind of, he clearly had a resonance beyond those. Obviously, yesterday will have had a meaning for Catholics. The world is 1.4 billion Catholics, but he did have a much, much broader appeal.
Yeah, no, I'm not a Catholic, but yeah. I was very moved by the entire sort of papacy of Pope Francis. I mean, I work on issues of global justice and human rights and migration and refugees. And as David said, you know, he was a religious figure. He did not change his stance on abortion. He would even link things like abortion and his opposition to abortion to his really, you know, innovative, revolutionary approach to climate issues and climate justice. But for those of us who aren't Catholic, I think it's really important for us to see such an important organization and such an important figure with so much sort of cultural and spiritual power to be making the gestures, which were more than gestures. You know, when he returned on the papal plane with actual refugees, you know, who would otherwise have been at the mercy of the international refugee system, I think, you know, these kinds of deeds go beyond the words and really reflect the church, which I have a great admiration for as a non-Catholic. All the parish priests, the people who work, lay and religious who work in migrant organizations, the priests and nuns who are on the missions, which are largely humanitarian NGOs who are heroes. You know, that he was sort of the head of that church, which we all, you know, benefit from.
Yeah, Aideen, it's kind of interesting. Ireland has much changed since Pope John Paul, when almost 90% of the Catholic or the population are identified as Catholic, and obviously that has dropped in I think it's probably around 69% now, I think. But do you think that this was special to Irish people? Do you think that this Pope had a special connection to Irish people?
Yeah, in a way I do. I mean, you can say, well, 69% of people still identify as Catholic. That's quite a lot in reality. And obviously there are a lot more people ticking the census box now as no religion. But I do think one of the things about Catholicism in Ireland is it's more than just a religion. It's part of how we identify ourselves. And that goes back, you know, to the history, to our history as a nation. So I do think so. People in Ireland who don't necessarily identify with the Catholic Church per se do identify with that element of our history and that element of who we are. So, yes, I do think it matters to people. I mean, obviously, his last visit in 2018 was a much more muted affair than the
chilly. Some people,
well, yes, indeed.
That
yeah, yeah. But I think he brought a number of people around. I mean, myself included, I have to be honest.
Because of the bigger issues like climate or migration.
Exactly. Yeah. And some of the places he visited and made a point of visiting. For example, he went to the Capuchin Day Friary and he met with people who are homeless. I believe, you know, he has been somebody who's spoken out on a number of very important issues. Things that are important to people, whether they're religious or they're not religious. I mean, particularly on climate change, particularly on migration. I was personally moved by his evening Zoom call every right. evening, apparently, including up till he died, with a congregation in Gaza of Catholics. And, you know, I think that kind of, for me, epitomised, you know, yes, of course, a lot of the duties of a leader of a church are the big picture things. But he was also somebody who could focus very, very clearly on the small things and the small things that matter. But I would also say, like a number of the commentators in the papers today, that for me as a woman, and, you know, I'm a sort of what you'd loosely call an a la carte Catholic. I attend high days and holy days.
Bouncy Castle Catholics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Once Catholic.
And the Bouncy Castles go up.
But, you know, I do accept, you know, some of the commentary that, you know, he did elevate women within the church to a degree. But when issues like the role of women and the ordination of women were put to him, his categorical answer to that was no. But then, you know, if we were to venture into a wider debate as to where the church goes from here, is it all going to be about the ordination of women, or is it going to be about a greater role for the laity?
Well, David Quinn, it's interesting. The Sunday Telegraph in London has a leader which says, for two millennia, the history of Western civilization has been inextricably linked to the history of the Catholic Church, which has shaped European culture on such a fundamental level that its influence can be hard to notice in the same way that we rarely notice the air that we breathe. And what they say is that the coming days we're going to be shifting our attention to the conclave. But he says, popes come and go, the church does not. And while each pontiff leaves their imprint, the underlying nature of the institution remains the same. There's been a lot of discussion in recent days about what's going to happen. Is there a fundamental tension between liberal and conservative? You don't think that is the case with Pope Francis? You think, as you say, he changed the mood, but not the doctrine.
I mean, I think, yeah, you see, we got to be a little bit resistant about applying political categories to the church, because a religion has to be understood first and foremost in religious terms.
But it takes very political stances.
Yes. But I mean, a church and sort of not just church, any religion, its job first and foremost is to point people towards God. And is it doing a good or a bad job doing that? And people kind of get a bit embarrassed when we talk about religion in religious terms, and therefore we talk about the church in sociological and political terms too much. Particularly church people need to get better about talking about religion in religious terms. I mean, it's what any pope ought to be about and what any pope ought to do.
You say, a pope does not, that's in your piece in the Sunday Independent today, a pope doesn't have the freedom to change core teachings of the church. He's as bound to them as any other Catholic. Mm-hmm. So essentially that at the end of the day, it's highly misleading to see popes in political terms as conservatives or liberals. Trying to force them into these categories can only be distorting. But there is a tension.
If I'm forced to categorise him politically, I would say that on many issues he would have been, and this is because partly of a South American background and his age, he'd be a man of the left. And that is why himself and Michael D. Higgins appear to get on extremely well. And Michael D. Higgins, of course, for years and years and years, has taken a special interest in South American politics and in sort of left-wing politics in South America. And I think Pope Francis would have had a very wary view of the United States, for example. He would often criticise America. I don't think he particularly liked the American church. And this is probably, again, coming from
I think what he railed against was the conflation of a certain type of MAGA-style nationalism with Catholicism.
Yeah, but I think it goes back further than that. I mean, he was 88 when he died. Was it 89?
88.
So he goes way back. He would have come of age in the 1960s and 70s. So that kind of attitude to America would be deep-rooted. And I'm not saying that, by the way, by way of criticism. I'm just saying if we're forced to categorise him, you could categorise him that way, essentially in sympathy with causes of the left.
David, for you to say, for instance, that a pope doesn't have that power, to make those kind of basic changes, which obviously is at odds with what people like Mary Mackey would say, and many others who would say that it is possible. But does that suit maybe if for instance, you do not believe and do not want women priests? Well, isn't that a belief that really suits that fits in very well with it?
A pope doesn't have the power that people think he has to change fundamental core teachings of the church. No pope has that power.
Can I ask you, with your permission, Derval, two questions. One, would you like to see women priests? And two, do you think that they can ever be, because you believe the rule can't be changed?
I think probably the rule can't be changed. I mean, to be honest, it is.
Well, Eilidh O'Hanlon,
would you like to see women priests?
I think that the male only priesthood is going to stay.
Would you like it to stay?
I think that's my view, yeah.
Okay. It's interesting because Aideen Eilidh O'Hanlon, who is on the opposite page of David Quinn today, points out the theological difference and saying the Pontifical Biblical Commission in 1976 did, after all, find out that nothing in Scripture ruled out women from becoming priests. And as we said yesterday, the early church certainly had women in leadership positions, and yet the other side of it it was 12 apostles, all male, and we can't change that. On the ordination of women and deacon priests, Aideen, do you have a view?
I'm sorry, do I have a view
on the ordination of women priests or women taking much more senior roles within the church?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I mean, my basic premise is women are equal. It is, you know, a cause to me of great concern that I continue, although it be occasionally, to go to Mass in an institution that does not recognise me as an equal. I mean, I've worked my way around that for different reasons, because I think it's good for me to reflect on my life. It's good for me to reflect on the values of society that I live in and so forth. But I do have a fundamental problem. I really do. I'm half of the world's population. And yet it's perfectly clear from everything that we saw at the Pope's funeral that 50% of the population are not represented in that institution by any stretch of the imagination. And you can have senior appointments within, you know, important positions within the church. But when it comes right down to what the church is fundamentally about, and that is fundamentally, it's about Mass, it's about the consecration, it's about being able to change water into wine and so on, when you look at this from a theological perspective. And from that perspective, women are not in that club. And I don't think there is any way, for me personally, that I can reconcile with that. Mm. And again, I was very drawn to this article, as you say, because, you know, where is this dogma? I mean, I don't remember. I grew up being told the Gospels are the word of God. I don't remember anything in any Gospel that I ever read
because
that said
a
woman could not be an apostle. I mean, we're all aware that women were written out of history over a period of time as we went through the centuries, second, third, fourth. The church itself as an institution changed historically. You had major changes, such as dynasties within the church, where papacies were inherited, bishoprics were inherited, and so on. There's an awful lot that happened between the death of Jesus and where we are today.
I don't think
any of it supports an idea that women should not have a role in the church.
Graham, look, we sort of touched on it yesterday. Either way, a schism would probably result. Do you have any hope that this issue will be touched by his successors?
I mean, I think maybe this is the Protestant in me. You know, I think if there's no scriptural objection, right, or basis for the exclusion of women from ordination, then doctrines can change. We see doctrinal innovation over the centuries. When Catholic social thought comes in the 19th century, that is a serious change of emphasis.
And liberation an interpretation. Theology.
Yeah, I mean, liberation theology was very, very much resisted by John Paul II, quite famously, but was embraced to a considerable extent by Francis. You know, Catholic social thought is an interpretation of Jesus's teachings, which I think is very powerful and kept the church relevant, you know, to a changing world in the 19th and early 20th century. If you look at my own tradition, and again, I'm a very secular member of the Church of Ireland, you know, the ordination of women priests prompted a very large backlash, you know, schismatic movements within the Church of England, but at the same time, you know, has revitalized the faith to some extent. And if you go to churches, you are very likely to see a woman priest.
David Quinn, what's interesting about, you know, when we turn our attention to the conclave is that the bishops or the cardinals will be meeting, having informal and formal discussions about the future direction of the church. And I wanted to ask you just, is the role of women, do you think, likely to feature in those? And when you look at that composition of the conclave, of those 108 out of the 135, I think it was Francis who actually had 108 of those appointments, 20 of them last December alone. Mm-hmm. So in terms of shaping I don't know whether popes can really, really shape the succession, but do you think that these are the kind of issues that are going to come before the conclave, particularly after the synod on synodality, that conversation, that great conversation that Pope Francis commenced?
I mean, if I can just say, first of all, I mean, there are obviously plenty of churches that have, married clergy, female clergy, that permit divorce, that permit contraception, have kind of ticked many of the boxes that liberals want them to tick. But this is a sociological point. Those churches have not revived, and that kind of interests me. And I'd love to know the reasons why they have not revived, because they have tried to fit with the times. and they've done the things that the kind of liberal times we live in want them to do, and yet they have not revived. And I think that's something that liberals themselves need to discuss. Why haven't the reforms of these churches? So, for example, Protestants, those Protestant churches remain empty. Liberals have not filled them, despite the fact that these churches have, as I say, moved with the times, so to speak. So that's something, if you like, kind of, you know, non-practicing liberal Protestants or post-Protestants need to explain why haven't those liberal reforms brought them back, and would they bring people back to the Catholic Church? And looking at the experience of the liberal Protestant churches, you would have to say no. And I think at the conclave, which you asked me about, I mean, they will be guided by considerations like that. But you see, like an awful lot of the cardinals now come from what they call the global south. And Pope Francis, when you know, Pope Francis was unusual in that he was picking cardinals from extremely unusual places like Mongolia.
He picked 25 cardinals from countries which previously didn't have one.
Yeah, and with tiny Catholic populations, so places like Tonga, places like Mongolia, places like Singapore, places like Myanmar, you know, the former Burma. So he liked to do this kind of thing. But they will have different concerns to Western people. So we can't look at the church purely from the point of view of our Western European or Western concerns.
It's a point well made, Alison O'Connor, is it not? Yesterday I was corrected by none other than Dr. Mary McAleese when I pointed out that under Pope Francis's leadership, the Catholic Church had actually grown by about 10% in the last 12 years, which reminded me, but yes, that's population growth in the global south. And it is true that particularly in the global south, where we're seeing, particularly in Nigeria, parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, you know, South America, it is a much, much more conservative type of Catholicism, perhaps the type of Catholicism we experienced in the 30s, 40s and 50s before the decline of the church here.
Absolutely. And just to pick up for a moment on what David was saying there, and I've heard that a couple of times this week in terms of basically saying that women aren't box office, they won't pull them into
the pew. Well, it's not even that.
They won't pull them into the pews.
It's all these teachings that have been changed.
I mean, yeah, that, clergy, you know, but for me, it's divorce. Not. But for me, observing it, it wouldn't be a matter of becoming more liberalism, that it's a matter of natural justice. As Aideen says, 15%.
Why doesn't it bring people back? That's my question.
That is an interesting question, but the very basic question for me is the issue of natural justice. Now, more widely, I suppose, like I didn't grow up, and it was unusual enough, didn't grow up for its time in a very religious household. And then as a young journalist...
But you spent a lot of time writing about it.
As a young journalist, yeah. I did a lot of work on clerical sex abuse. I wrote a book on clerical sex abuse in Ferns, particularly on Father Sean Fortune, Father Brendan Smith, a lot of work that you'd have done yourself. And I suppose in my experience of that, and I know it's a long time ago and some things have changed, what I suppose cemented it for me a lot was never in any one instance for all of those victims did the church do anything in any way that didn't make the situation worse.
Well, that's completely true.
You know, and I suppose to move on from that then,
Is it about numbers, Alison, right? Is it about numbers? Yeah. Because one of the big things that everyone has been crediting Pope Francis with was that he was the evangelist, that he brought the church back to its missionary, and it was all about service. Yeah. So is it a question, you know, David is saying, well, look at the Protestant or post-Protestant churches, they didn't grow numbers. And is it about the numbers?
You see, I think ultimately it is, actually. And I think it is about, and maybe Francis recognised this, that you'd break the church. You just spoke about the very different attitudes in very different places and the places where. So this is what I wonder. I mean, it's 70%, isn't it, nearly, we said, identify as Catholic in the census. I mean, that to me is a muscle memory. If you went into any, just people saying that, you go into any church this morning, you wouldn't see anywhere near 70%.
It'd be more like 15%.
Of the congregation.
But would it not in that cultural, area. But as the Telegraph says, there is a cultural Catholicism that I suppose endures.
Yes, no, it does. But and also that sense that who amongst us wouldn't want to go somewhere where you have a weekly chance maybe to reflect or to be with your community. But for me, there's still too much wrong with the Catholic Church to do that on a weekly basis. But I do, I feel a sympathy for women particularly, and for the men who would like to see women priests and other changes, LGBTQ people, plus people, things like that, that really, those things, to my mind, particularly this week with all I've read and all I've heard, they're never going to change, because for that very reason, it would break the church. It would cause a schism. So if you're looking for that, I'd look
elsewhere. Can I just add one point, you know? you know, you mentioned the idea of, you know, all of these changes within other churches have not brought the masses come flooding back. But if you look at the evolution of church, whether it be Catholic Church or Protestant churches, they've been over centuries, okay? You're talking about changes that have been decades. I think it takes a lot longer than that, for starters, to really... I mean, it's not like, you know, our next Bishop of Dublin, Mary Mackley's, just for the sake of argument, begins to draw in the big numbers. But there's another factor to all
but
of this.
But the decline actually gets worse.
No, but I'm not totally agreeing with you that the decline gets worse. There's a lot of research out there that shows that people are actually growing, have a growing concern around spirituality. It may not be a growing concern around Catholicism or formalized religion, but they have a growing concern about spirituality. And I think part of the reason that you're not going to get the box office numbers back into the church if you were to change things all of a sudden, which wouldn't happen anyway, is because there's been a fundamental break of trust between members of the church.
But do these
the
things not go
itself. I mean, in
but
terms
I'm talking
of the,
about not
in terms of the, in terms
well.
Of the endemic abuse that went on within the church,
no, that's obviously
I really believe it is going to take a lot for people who grew up with that church to forgive it and to come back. And it will be a lot easier to forgive it if they see the church moving in a direction that they feel is the right way to go. And I would make one more point. It isn't just all about women and their involvement in the church. It's also about the laity. It's like Alison said, the people who make the tea and sandwiches. You know, you go along, what's the role of the laity? They read at Mass and they pick up the collection. Where's the real role for the laity in the church these days? And I think that's something that has to be addressed.
Well, some of them are stepping in, David Quinn, covering at funerals and providing other priestly-like, I suppose, tasks as the vocations crisis grips.
I mean, again, I'd love to hear it properly discussed. Why aren't the liberal Protestant churches reviving? And like, it's not a question for me to answer. It's probably a question for somebody like Graham to answer, who comes from that background.
Graham, but why are they not reviving? There well, we go, while you're here.
I think there's a lot. This is, anybody who knows me knows that me as a representative of global Protestantism is ludicrous. I mean, you are seeing tremendous growth in some churches, and you're seeing people who are spiritually oriented in this very town going to things like the Unitarian Church, which is also growing in prosperous parts of the United States.
We probably won't get the answer to that, but it's a completely different program. But even the growth of like evangelical churches here, it's not that people have lost a spirituality, David Quinn, they may have lost it.
Yeah,
in.
I mean, to refer to Aideen's point.
Maybe they need women to dominate. Maybe it isn't enough that women are equal.
So people are, there's a permanent part of human nature that searches for meaning and purpose. Okay, and what religion, never mind just Catholicism, just religion in general, tries to provide as a sense of meaning, purpose, transcendence, awe. It addresses questions like forgiveness, love, repentance, redemption, eternal life, right and wrong. I mean, these, you know, how to handle issues like suffering. These are the most important questions possible in human life, and they're the questions that religion tries to address, and it addresses them either well or badly. But these are just fundamental questions of the human condition. And if religion is bad at addressing these things and addressing these needs, then obviously it needs to reform itself. And this is the question for all religions, but it's also the question for humans in general. How do they approach all these absolutely fundamental issues of meaning and purpose?
Well, I wasn't expecting things to get so existential.
One of the few
so
cultural,
quickly.
Sorry to jump in here, but and I know you probably have to go to a break, but one of the few cultural, sociological universals or near universals is that women are more religious than men. Across religions, across countries, and so
mainly
forth.
True, yes.
And we, you know, that is an opportunity for the church. I'm a little uncomfortable talking about churches in terms of box office, like they're a superhero movie. But, you know, I do think that women's experience is going to be core as part of the church going
into the future. Alison, something that is box office, literally metaphorically, is the conclave, you know, and the ability of the conclave to capture imaginations in art, in film, is just extraordinary. And like, when you're looking at the papal front runners and any amount of runners and riders, the continuity candidates, you know, the liberal, the moderate, you know, the orthodox, hardliner. Look, I mean, apart from the ritual of it, like, I mean, I suppose our captivation with the conclave is really, really something else, isn't it?
Yeah, but I suppose there it is. It's the, and even I suppose growing up, you can still remember the suspense of the conclave and looking to see the colour of the smoke and all of that. And I do find it incredible, this idea that they say canvassing isn't allowed. I mean, it's impossible to imagine. It may be called something else or carried, you know, but it's difficult to see how that doesn't happen. Particularly the fact that Pope Francis appointed so many new cardinals and so many of them are unknown to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that they have to become, you know, I mean, how are you going to know whether somebody is suitable as a pope unless you hear them set literally to set out their next stall? And that it's also, I mean, it's, we're going to be, we, it does strike me as well, we're going to be well poped out of it by the, if it doesn't happen quickly.
There might be under pressure.
We
to
are
get,
going to be. Well,
to get a quick result, David Quinn. David Quinn, they have Cardinal Farrell, the Drimleborn Cardinal Farrell at 17-1. He's not in the running. In terms of those kind of papal front runners, who do you think are kind of maybe the top two or three, as you see it?
Yeah, well, I mean, because so many of these cardinals don't know each other, they might go for those who are known quantities. So a person that keeps on getting mentioned, I see in the Sunday, Independent Sunday Times today, is Cardinal Parolin. He's the current Secretary of State of the Vatican, which makes him, kind of formally speaking, the number two man in the Vatican. So he knows the church well. All the cardinals know him.
And that would keep it in Europe?
He'd be the first Italian since before John Paul II. So he'd be a kind of a continuity candidate, and they might regard him as kind of steady pair of hands. So he tends to be mentioned as favourite. My kind of personal favourite, but I don't think he'd get it because he's too young, but I think he's a great backstory, is the wonderfully named Cardinal Pete Saballa.
Yeah,
so he's an Italian and a Franciscan.
At the tender age of 60.
Yeah, tender age of 60, you see, so it'll be a long pontificate, so probably why they won't go for him. But he's the Latin patriarch, as they call it, of Jerusalem. So he has learned incredibly good diplomatic skills there in trying to keep the Israeli government on side, Muslims on side, Arab Christians, who of course are his primary concern, on side. And he seems to have done a good job in that respect. He's quite a charismatic individual. He seems to be quite a holy individual. Kind of centrist, yeah, if I can put it that way.
Well, the Sunday Times notes that when Hamas gunmen invaded Israel in the October 7th attacks, he offered himself in exchange for children who had been taken hostage, and said, on his positions, broadly thought to be a moderate conservative, but little is known about his theological positions, given his short time in the post and his focus on the conflict in the Middle East.
I mean, I suppose my prediction is not any particular individual. I think what they're going to try and go for is somebody who's kind of a halfway house between Francis and John Paul II. I think they probably, famous last words, want a fairly quiet period.
The continuity cardinal, potentially. I think it's May the 6th, is it before? Obviously the 9 days of mourning, so not until May the 6th, but I'm sure we'll be chatting about it loads. But I guess at 11:40, we should probably take a quick break. Thanks. You're all very, very welcome back. With me are Alison O'Connor, Dr. Graham Finlay, Aidan Hayden and David Quinn. Graham, the photos that were circulated yesterday of the two figures hunched over in that dramatic setting of St. Peter's Basilica, Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky, I suppose perhaps time will tell whether it was an iconic or picture or not. A lot of the coverage in today's paper, the analysis of Russia-Ukraine, sort of didn't capture perhaps that iconic image. Perhaps they went to press too early, but a lot of a sense of, yeah, Ukraine are in a tough position, but they should just take whatever deal's available.
Yeah, there are a couple of very stark articles, one by Barry O'Halloran in the Sindo about how, you know, Europe could end up going to war with Russia within 5 years, which is pretty grim thinking, and by Mark Galliotti in the Times about how it's a terrible deal and but Zelensky should accept it. And both of them are about the threat posed beyond, Ukraine. And I think Galliotti's argument is something.
Presumably mindful of what happened in Crimea.
Yeah, and this is going to come to us, right? And so much of it is a little navel-gazing on the part of the UK and Europe about, you know, what the consequences are for them. Both of them agree that Europe is going to have to seriously rearm to and get more involved and possibly put boots on the ground in Ukraine to even make this deal work, which the Europeans are very, very leery of. So it's a terrible time for Ukraine.
Well, the Europeans perhaps in the West, as opposed to those nice. Aideen, Trump's peace deal is terrible. Ukraine should still accept it. That was Mark Galeotti's piece in the Sunday Times.
Yeah, again, you know, a pretty stark analysis of the situation and what the realities are for Ukraine. I mean, it's been in a state of war now for 3 years. It's a war, it's not winning, and that's the reality of it. And it's been put in a position now where its chief ally, the ally that said it would never back down in support of Ukraine, has now made it absolutely clear that if it doesn't take the deal on the table, I mean, all bets are off in terms of any future support. You know, the timing is poor in terms of where Europe is at. I mean, clearly there's a huge European support for supporting Ukraine. And part of that is self-interest, because, as you said, I mean, what happens, you know, Russia gets a bit of a breather, chance to regroup. What's the next target going to be? And really the bottom line of all of this is, first of all, Zelensky's, I think, position at home. How much can he afford to give away without breaking confidence with his supporters back home?
Well, it's very hard to negotiate a deal when you're in a very, very weak position. Yeah. But
very, very, very difficult. I mean, look, the reality is, you know, Europe will have to, over the next period, see itself more as a European defence organization. We're going to have to completely review the whole NATO situation, and I think probably the only way forward for Europe is to you know, accept the writing on the wall that NATO really isn't going to be a feature in the European future. I think that's part of it. I think the other part, though, in terms of Ukraine, is we have to say what guarantees will there be there for any Ukrainian deal? Who is going to defend the Ukrainian deal at the end of the day? And I do think that America's
and
not going to do that.
What do you think about Trump's relationship with Putin now? Obviously, you know, out on social media earlier this week saying, Vladimir, stop. And then obviously yesterday, the statement that he issued after the meeting with Zelensky, you know, saying, you know, maybe he's just sort of, you know, tapping me along here, and maybe we need to think about another way, you know, including sanctions. What do you think happened, or what do you imagine was the... But given how mercurial he is and how often he and his administrative officials can change. But what did you think of that mood music shift yesterday?
I mean, it's sort of hard to follow the mood music when it changes quicker than a Spotify playlist, you know? I mean, it's Trump has one goal, which is to get a peace deal quick so he doesn't have to worry about it, carry out his promises, because Trump loves being seen to carry through on his promises. And he doesn't really much care about what the deal looks like. And he thinks he can force Ukraine into a deal. That's why all of the current deal on offer involves concessions to Russia, gives Russia pretty much everything it wants. He doesn't like, you know, this minute seeing horrible pictures of Russian missile strikes on Kyiv. So it's really hard to see this as a successful bargaining strategy if you just keep hitting people back and forth until, you know, the deal happens. So, and it's hell for the people who are actually living that particular situation. I think Zelensky will be pressured into a deal. I think there are two big problems. One for Zelensky is any concession of territory and the actual language surrounding it, like recognizing Crimea as Russian territory, is unacceptable. And it doesn't seem to be part of the final deal. But I was struck by, in the vox pops of Ukrainians in Ireland around the prospect of land for peace, a number of them talk, these are ordinary Ukrainians on the street, talked about the prospect of a civil war. And we in this country know all about it. So that's very, very worrisome. The other one is the inevitable two-track and the tensions between the EU approach and the American approach. If Donald Trump sort of dusts his hands and says, right, peace deal done, walks away, the EU is not going to have to just step up, but there's going to be a question about whether we maintain sanctions while the US alleviates sanctions, or are we supposed to back up the removal of sanctions on Russia, which has caused serious problems
for
their
economy. And David Quinn, the warning, I suppose, that Barry Halloran was talking about, you know, there are European countries that have had to, that are very, very close to the conflict, very close to those borders, and have particular concerns, including security concerns. We've experienced that war in the European continent, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, largely as a hospitality issue in terms of dealing with refugees. But it is that warning that, you know, if you don't support Ukraine now, who's next?
You see, I mean, I think Russia has actually proven itself to be extraordinarily militarily weak in this conflict. I mean, the idea was it was going to have taken Kiev in 3 days and nothing like that happened. In fact, the front lines have been more or less frozen for the last 2 years and there's hardly any budging going on. Lots and lots and lots of people dying. And the war could go on another 3 years with many, many more people dead and the front line still barely budging. So I think there will have to be, you know, a deeply unsatisfactory ceasefire from Ukraine's point of view, you know, given the very dismal prospects of this ending otherwise. And they're going to have to swallow probably roughly the current front lines. They don't have to recognise anything that Russia has seized. They can hope, I guess, in a post-Putin era, they get a more sensible Russian leader. But given the...
Which isn't necessarily...
No, it's not guaranteed at all. I mean, this is what often happens to conflicts. They peter out, as what happened in the Korean. I mean, there's never actually been a formal peace deal on the Korean Peninsula, which is amazing when you think that war ended about 70 years ago. They simply had a ceasefire, never a peace agreement. So it could be something like that here. Does they permanently, or at least indefinitely, freeze it along the front lines? But I think there's extremely tiny prospects of Russia being able to move any further. Because Russia, even in a time of war, is spending far less on its military than Europe spends combined.
Can I bring you, Alison O'Connor, onto something different, which is there's a lot of coverage in the international papers about Donald Trump's 100 days in office, but there's a lot of coverage in the Irish papers this weekend on Micheál Martin's first 100 days.
There certainly is. And just briefly on Donald Trump, Andrew Sullivan, the conservative thinker in the Sunday Times, is making the point. He's saying it's basically an elected monarchy, a monarchy nonetheless. He says, and one person controls everything, and so far, no one and nothing is constraining him. And I think that sums up sort of the Trump so far in those 18 days. But elsewhere in the Sunday Times, Jennifer Bray
and Claire Scott
are covering the first 100 days of Micheál Martin, his second time around as Taoiseach. And they're
and his potential end day as Taoiseach.
Did sort of make me smile a bit in that it may happen, but there have been more reportings and rumours of Micheál Martin sailing into the sunset than you and I have had cups of tea. So they're saying the first one is that about him stepping down in late summer of 2027, that there's a feeling amongst many people in Fianna Fáil, and that the second is that it's Jim
O'Callaghan.
To give his successor a chance exactly before the next election.
And Jim O'Callaghan, coming from wilderness to...
He was up with the front runners and then he slipped back and now he's back up again. And I think I can see why that has happened. He has been so far been doing a good job. One of the ministers who has come out of the traps early, and despite everything that was going on in the Dáil about speaking times and all of that, has managed to make an imprint on his portfolio. But that brings us on to the third thing, which is the third is that Fianna Fáil party is seized with dread over the housing crisis. And that, I suppose, highlights a minister, James Brown, like Jim O'Callaghan, a first time minister, but the sense that he has not made an impression, and that there are worries about whether he is up to the job. Initially, it was felt that he was put in there as a new minister and that Micheál Martin was going to be the one pulling the strings. And that may well be the case. But so far, we've seen all the various figures that have come out where the government, the controversy over them overpromising before the election, and all of the mood music being very negative since. The big story in the papers today is that we're going to get this new housing czar, Brendan McDonagh, who is
the former chief executive of
the NTMA, and that he will be and he is going to basically knock heads together and get everything going, which you have to, when you consider the amount of resources, funding, time, political capital that has been spent on housing so far. It's extraordinary, the idea now that we're going to get this person
in. Is it extraordinary, Aidan, that we need a housing czar on top of a housing minister? Do you think that is a good move?
It's not necessarily a bad move, to be honest. I mean, the idea of, a special, call it whatever you will, the office for delivery, the office for innovation, the office for whatever.
Somebody who's going to knock heads, that's
what essentially. Yeah, but there have been different iterations of that since Under Rebuilding Ireland was published in 2016. It was mooted during as one of the recommendations from the Housing Commission report. Look, there is an issue with infrastructure in particular. And if the role of the czar, and most of the commentary has been about his salary, let alone the job.
More than the Taoiseach and the US president.
Yes, but, yes. I think we should just focus on the issue here. Is he going to be in a position to achieve something something that will actually unleash some of the barriers that are there? And there are significant barriers in relation to housing. I mean, the news is very bad on housing. And I'm not just talking about political arguments over the outcomes in the last quarter of last year. I'm talking, generally speaking, going forward. The mood music for this year in terms of outcomes is also very poor.
And that the figures could be worse. Could ultimately be worse.
The figures could get worse. But there's also an indication here. The government have cancelled out of a number of schemes. If not cancelled out of them, rode them back. One of them being the tenant in situ scheme, which was a scheme where people at risk of homelessness could have their properties bought by local authorities. Mm. It's been an incredibly successful scheme in preventing homelessness. That has been rowed back on very significantly. There's another scheme, the financial contribution scheme, which allows people in properties that are, too big for them or whatever, to move into local authority properties for senior citizens. Again, another scheme that's money has been rowed back from. I'm hearing from people at Frontline Delivery that money is being held back. It's not being spent. Certainly not at the rates that it was being spent in the last 2 years. Well, you kind of wonder, on the one hand, the government are saying they've huge commitment to housing. On the other hand, they're looking at a financial future where we are looking at the impacts of the tariff wars and so on. And this isn't yesterday or the day before. I mean, the government have been focused on that for quite a long period of time. So, we have an issue with housing, and you get a lot of people putting forward quick fix solutions. Let's have older people right-sizing, for example.
Not downsizing.
Yeah. Let's get big institutional money into this country to build-to-rent apartments. With nobody asking the question, by the way, do we actually want a private rented sector that is currently 20%? Do we actually want that to be a bigger sector?
Yet you need the involvement of the private sector.
Yeah, we've seen
home
ownership fall in this country down to 67%. That is a massive drop in this country. That means a lot of people in our society, older people, will be living in rented accommodation they can't afford. Nobody's asking the question, why do we keep going down a road that is not necessarily in our better interests?
Well, let's answer that after this quick break. David Quinn, if you were on social media last night, the amount of people who were at the protests in Dublin yesterday ranged from 10,000 to 100,000. It is picked up in one or two of the papers this morning.
Yeah, and there's something in the Sunday Independent on page 4 about it. It mentions a figure of 10,000, which is still a substantial number of people. I mean, I was kind of distracted, obviously, by the papal funeral, so I was paying very little attention to what was going on at the city centre in terms of that. I see it was a small counter-demonstration as well. Unfortunately, none of it resulted in violence. This obviously would have been a concern about that. I do think, though, in terms of the housing crisis, there's obviously both a supply side to it, can we build enough, and there's also a demand side to it. We happen to be in a country which has one of the fastest growing populations in the European Union. I saw Dan O'Brien, the economist, drawing attention to that on Twitter the other day. And so, are there ways in which we can reduce for a time population growth in order to allow the country's infrastructure to catch up? And I think that question needs to be put into the debate as well.
Yeah, but it's interesting because there are so, particularly when you look at the critical skills list, like we have huge shortages in certain areas, in terms of demand for work permits, Alison O'Connor, sometimes whether it's healthcare workers, home care workers, the economy is looking for workers, critical skills that we don't have.
Yes, and I mean, I suppose this, and anyone who has been in hospital or who has a relative in hospital sees how so much of that care is delivered by people who are here on work visas, and that the strain that our health service is already under, it would likely collapse.
There was a figure I saw recently, and it's the number of overseas nurses working in various European countries, and it really struck me. So here it's about 50%, I think, of nurses are from overseas. In Denmark, which is a similar country to us, it's only 5%. So I'd love to know what is going on in Denmark. They're able to hold on to their nurses. So these are the sort of things that also need to be thrown into the debate.
But
why have we become so dependent?
Yeah, but our situation as it exists today is the one we're faced with, and the fact that if they all walked out the door tomorrow, we would be left with nobody to run our hospitals and care for people.
Yeah,
similarly, in nursing homes.
But we've been doing some studies about this at UCD. But one thing the government can do is to make innovations in its employment-based visa system, which allow people already in the country, already housed, like the spouses of general work permit holders or the spouses of those nurses, who are very often men, you know, to work as well, because these people are already here. They already have housing, and they can, you know, fill those roles. So if we treat our employment-based migrants better, it will actually work better for the society as well.
Well, I'm afraid that is all we have time for, because it's coming up to 12. My thanks to Alison O'Connor, Dr. Graeme Finlay, Aideen Hayden and David Quinn. And we are now going to cross over to the newsroom